WCHD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
Enlightened philosophers tell us that we are divine beings in human form. Let's get real here. How can we live a busy life with a job, kids, and a mortgage and still be spiritual? Join CJ Liu as she tackles real life issues through a spiritual lens and talks with experts in relationships, work, and more. You'll get practical life skills and learn how to touch, feel, and experience a whole new way of living. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on fireitupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
Welcome into Fire It Up with CJ. I'm Cassandra and I'm here with you today. We are now.
Hi,
CJ.
Hey, everybody. This is live from the headquarters of CBS. It's a Fire It Up with CJ show. Now you can find us on fireitupwithcj.com. It is June, and in June, it's really all about the focus of this month is exploring what it will take to live in balance and harmony with the environment. Today, we actually are going to take this opportunity because it's halfway through the year. Can you believe that?
I can't. I refuse.
I know. It's just kind of shocking to think that we're halfway through the year. And I actually thought, well, let's use this as an opportunity to contemplate, you know, how things are going. And today we're going to be looking at the limits of the Earth's capacity to serve us. I mean, it's becoming clearer that, you know, we're going to hit limits. It's kind of like we've been on an all day eating buffet, and we have stopped. And at one point, there will be limits on how much we can consume. So today we talked to Stan Cox, author of Losing Our Cool, who was named by Atlantic Magazine in 2012 the Reader's Choice for being a brave thinker. And a brave thinker is someone who they defined as someone who's risked their reputation, fortunes, and lives in pursuit of big ideas. So today we're going to be discussing his next big idea. So welcome, Stan.
Oh, hi, CJ.
It's great to have you here, and I'm excited to talk about your book, your new book, Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Your New Idea is?
Rationing.
Rationing. I didn't cue it up. Maybe I should have had a drum roll. Would that have been better?
Right. Well, yeah, it's been referred to as the equivalent of shouting an obscenity in church. So a lot of people don't like to hear the word.
I know. I love one of the reviews on your book review on Amazon. It's like, next to hemorrhoids, people do not
right.
want to talk about rationing. And, in fact, when I was writing the marketing promotions, I thought, I don't know if I can use the word rationing because people have such a negative reaction to it. It's kind of sad.
Well, people, when I was going to be writing the book, there were people who said, well, use some other words, but I thought it's better to attack the concept head on because a lot of people who don't think that we're consuming too much or affecting the Earth's ecosystems too much and don't want to see us pull back, that's the word they use. They say, well, if we do that, we'll have rationing, not realizing or not admitting anyway that we ration all the time. It's just a matter of how to ration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of budgeting. Do people have less of a response to budgeting, or do people have a negative response to that as well?
Well, you know, people, yeah, that's a pretty well accepted idea of budgeting, but it's somewhat different from the available supply of something is not sufficient to meet all the demand for it. And generally that happens because of some kind of an emergency or war or other calamities. But it could also happen if we intentionally try to limit the quantities of resources we use or the quantities of pollution we produce. That's really the big decision, is to put limits around our economy. If we did that, then if prices then were just left to do what they would do, they would go up because there'd be a lower supply and more demand. That becomes very unfair for a large segment of the population who would no longer be able to afford what they need. Mm-hmm. And that's when some kind of fair shares rationing becomes necessary.
Right. So you were cutting in and out, but what I think I heard you say is that at one point we're going to have a limit in our supply of these valuable resources, whether it's the amount of carbon emissions that the Earth can take, or the amount of water, or even the amount of health care that we consume. And so if we were to let market economy dictate, then what would happen is those supplies diminish, your prices would go up. But when we start thinking about the prices going up for water, then that's a fairness issue, which is, does that mean, is it fair for certain people to have water and others not to? Is that what you meant by that? When I missed parts of what you said because I was fading in and out. Sorry.
Right. Yeah, sorry. I'm. Yes, that's right. And water is a resource that we're accustomed to seeing rationed all the time. When certain localities have a drought, they will limit lawn watering and things like that. More severe needs for rationing have come in wartime, when there is a limit on what's available to the consumer economy because a lot of resources are going elsewhere. And that's when you get this often this hyperinflation. But if the government says, okay, we're limiting prices, there's not going to be war profiteering for basic essentials, the price is limited to this amount, then unless you have some fair shares method of sharing resources, you have a lot of social strife and shortages and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, one of the chapters that you have in the book is about water rationing, and what I thought was sad, but is the reality in certain countries like India, is that, you know, people need at least 13 gallons of water to sustain just a quality of life, right, for just day in, day out use. And in those countries, people get less than that, right? I mean, so if in a world of rationing, we would have, you know, 13 gallons of water each household. Is that what it would look like, or what do you think it would look like if we went to a world of rationing with water?
Yeah, well, you know, water is always a local issue, and there are places in the world that are always going to be water limited in arid regions of the world, and then there are other places where there are high densities of population, and that would be the case, say, in Mumbai, India, where the city goes to extraordinary efforts to get water to every part of town, and a lot of places don't get it at all. But if you look if you do a news search in any given month and search for water rationing, it's happening somewhere in the world, many places in the world all the time. Recently in Dublin, Ireland, of all places, very wet place there, they were having to ration water. It's a pretty much an everyday occurrence in places like Amman, Jordan, or cities I've lived in India, where your water may only run for 30 minutes a day coming from the city, and so you better get the water that you need during that time.
Yeah, that was kind of a shocking. You don't appreciate how critical water is until you think, Oh, if I lived in Mumbai, you know, from 8 to 8:30, there's water coming out. And if I'm not there with my gallons of jugs of water, I'm not getting any water for the day or the week or whatever. I mean, it's kind of shocking. And because sometimes, and from your book, it's sometimes water doesn't even come out every day. Is that right?
Well, the thing that impressed me in that one small neighborhood in Mumbai is the kind of social organization that's necessary to make sure that with only 30 minutes of water running and there's only one tap, it's a pretty high volume tap, but there's only one tap running for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
The
God.
Highly choreographed routine that the people of the neighborhood go through, filling pots and hauling them back to their homes, coming back and filling more, and they make allowances for people who live farther away, and everybody gets what they need. But it's they actually had to fight for that 8 to 8:30 p.m. slot. It was coming on at something like 3 in the morning, which
Oh my God.
Was totally unacceptable.
Oh, my God. I hope we don't reach that point. I mean, when you and as I was reading through your book, I kept on thinking, when will this happen to us? Is this going to happen to me when I'm 90, or going to happen to my kids? I mean, when do you think, you know, based on all of the research that you did, is rationing? I'm part of what I'm hearing you say. Rationing is already a reality. So get over your issues with the word rationing and whatever thing it means to you, because it's happening already. But when do you see this as being a worldwide phenomena?
Right. It kind of depends on which resources we're talking about. And the four that I focused on were energy and carbon emissions, which can kind of are sort of rationed at the same time, then water, food, and medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Medical care, as you say, a lot of resources, it's already being rationed. Right now, we do it by discriminating against certain groups of people, like those who don't have adequate health insurance. Mm-hmm. More sensible rationing would involve discriminating against ineffective treatments that are not worth the cost. And that mm-hmm. That could be where, if we finally come to our senses, that may be where we first see rationing. And it has happened in some parts of the world. The thing with carbon emissions is interesting. That is, true rationing isn't happening anywhere right now, but there have been proposals discussed in Britain about how a nation could assign a certain annual quantity of carbon emissions that's the right of every citizen, and you would receive credits every year into your carbon account to produce that many emissions and you would have to spend those credits when you buy fuel for your car or pay your utility bills. Those would be the main places that you would use them.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually debated in Parliament. It hasn't been passed into law there or anywhere. But that either rationing by carbon emissions or rationing fossil fuel use could, in the next couple of decades, we could see that.
Yeah, and it would make sense that that would happen. I guess the thing that's interesting and the point that you bring up in the book is we have to start rationing because, you know, oil will run out, and it will run out. There's not as if we can ration something that doesn't exist.
Right. And even if you know, people are very impressed now by these huge reserves of unconventional oil. And even if we did decide to exploit those at the huge environmental costs that it would require, and even if we did get access to a lot more natural gas and oil, that would be an even bigger disaster if we decided we would burn it at the current increasing rate around the world that we are. So it's going to be a case of a kind of an unprecedented thing. Rationing before has always been done in the case of absolute scarcity, where scarcity is imposed by some outside mm-hmm. forces. This would have to be voluntary kind of scarcity, where we said mm-hmm. there is a ceiling as a nation or a world that we're not going to burn more fossil fuel than this each year, and then figure out how to live within that limit.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're going to be talking more about that precisely, fossil fuels and greenhouse emissions and what rationing may look like. We talked about England, but we're going to dive into that a little bit more. So we have Stan Cox, whose book, Any Way You Slice It, looks at a potential future of what we'll encounter if we don't have voluntary limits on ourselves, if we don't stop ourselves from eating at the all-you-can-eat buffet. It is not an all-you-can-eat buffet. So.
Right. Yeah. The chicken runs out eventually.
Exactly. Okay, folks, make sure to subscribe to us by going to www.firedupwithcj.com, and you'll get a schedule of upcoming shows, articles, and be eligible to win freebies. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, firedupwithcj.com, and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky. The Sky.
Welcome back. Today we have Stan Cox, who The Atlantic magazine names in its 2012 Reader's Choice as a brave thinker. Fans out there, make sure you get more shows like this one at firedupwithcj.com. I'm Cassandra, live from CBS Sky Radio, and we're going to go right back to CJ and Stan.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm CJ Liu, and as Kermit the Frog said, it ain't easy being green, and it's especially hard for us Americans. The Global Footprint Network looked at the world's ecological footprint, and it looked at the resource consumption and waste production and the Earth's biological capacity to absorb the footprint. So based on how we're consuming right now, can the Earth take it? And the bad news is, in order to reach Earth's capacity, we have to reduce our global footprint by 45%. To be brought in line with the global biocapacity. And sorry, Americans, but our situation is even worse. If equity and fairness was an issue and we were to put our numbers in line with the rest of the world, as Americans, we would have to shrink our footprint by 80%. So hard news, I know. And I think, one of the reactions that could happen is people can go like, I don't want to hear it, shut your ears off, and go into a state of denial. Like, just let's hope this isn't true and CJ's wrong with her numbers. I hope this doesn't happen. And I think that that's an understandable reaction, but also I think we need to face the facts. This reality is hitting us, and the world can't take our consumption anymore. So I would encourage folks who are kind of in that state of like, oh my God, I just want to shut everything off. Shut off your air conditioning and your heat, but don't shut off the show. All right, so we have our next guest, Stan Cox, and we're going to be looking at what the world would look like if we had greenhouse emissions. Welcome back, Stan.
Good to be here.
So I found the options interesting and kind of alarming at the same time in terms of if we were to reduce our overall greenhouse emissions. There's policies out there about cap and trade, taxes, and even birth rationing as ways of lowering our emissions. Can you step us through what some of those things are and how they work?
Yes. Probably the most widely discussed possibility for a long time has been a carbon tax, which NASA scientist James Hansen has pushed for a long time, and as have others. That would be a kind of an indirect way of trying to reduce emissions by putting a tax on fossil fuels, which would raise the price of fuels along with a lot of other things that the fuels are necessary for producing. That would also create some unfairness because lower income households would have a harder time. Part of the plan would be, though, to take the revenues from the tax and reimburse everyone on a per capita basis. So that would reintroduce some fairness, but it still would be a kind of, it would be a very indirect and not as fair way of trying to reduce emissions as a more explicit rationing plan.
Yeah, and when I read your book, it was like, so let's say that right now in Seattle, a gallon of gas is $4, that this tax may make, I mean, the example that you use in your book, is, if I understood it correctly, was that it'd be $8 a gallon. Or, you know, some large tax, it wouldn't be like $4.50, it would be $8, in which case the fairness issue comes along where you say, well, not everyone can afford $8 per gallon with that kind of tax. And so the reimbursement would be like, okay, for those people who, you know, we're going to take that $4 excess and invest it in what? What would they be investing that $4 in, and what would the reimbursement be? I mean, how would that work?
Well, I assume it would come back like your income tax refund every year. Everybody would get a check. So that would not only recycle the money from the tax, but it would serve as, just like those other refunds do, as an economic stimulus, which would encourage further consumption and partially negate some of the effect of the tax. And nobody knows how the taxes would have to be to successfully reduce consumption. And rationing really wouldn't be a direct alternative to that. The direct alternative to that carbon tax would be to have, as I was talking about before, an absolute limit in terms of barrels or of oil or tons of coal that the nation would not exceed. And then, and that should decline over time. And then in trying to figure out how to make sure everybody has sufficient access to resources, that's when, under that ceiling, then that's when some type of rationing would become necessary.
Yeah, so in that particular case, let's say that, you know, CJ gets 20 gallons of, you know, oil, Stan gets 20 gallons of oil, you know, whomever is out there, everyone gets 20 gallons of oil or so much of a card of energy that we can consume with the corresponding carbon emissions associated with it. And then, as I understand it, so we would get a card of some sort. I think that's what England was proposing, right? It was a card of some sort that they put a limit on. Is that right? Am I getting my data correct?
That's right. And the you know, the trucking lines would only get so much oil, and Google would get only so much electricity to run their servers. And so everybody would be working out the most efficient way they could do what they need to do given those limitations.
Yeah, and then in that particular case, as I understand it, let's say that CJ gets 20 gallons, and because I'm so energy efficient and smart about the way, and I ride my bike everywhere, whatever, I only use 10 gallons, then I could either take that 10 gallons and trade it in or get money or sell it back. Is that the idea of the trade, the cap and the trade part? Is that the same idea as cap and trade?
Well, no, the what we're used to talking about with cap and trade is at the national level and involving the say utilities or, you know, heavy industry and governments and corporations. But the British proposals for carbon rationing have incorporated that very thing you're describing, a kind of a personal cap and trade, so that if you either are very responsible or you're poor and just can't afford to spend all of your carbon credits, either way, you could sell them into a national carbon market and get money. And people who have used up their credits and need to get to work or whatever could buy at a pretty stiff price. They could buy credits that you've sold and be able to buy more fuel. But the overall, that would keep the overall level of carbon emissions at a constant level.
Right. So then we could really truly ration where the overall supply would be monitored versus the taxes. Who knows? If you would hope, there's this hope that this indirect way would limit the amount of consumption and so, and keep our supplies lowered, but who knows if that would happen. But this in the cap, personal cap and trade, that would be kind of assured.
But we would have to avoid the mistakes that have been made in the international cap and trade schemes in which there are ways to buy out of limits with these offsets where you can get credits by paying somebody to plant trees in Indonesia or something.
Yeah, right.
And there are a lot of very shady things going on in ways that they can lift the cap or put, you know, pressure valves and all these things. And so it would... It would have to be a very firm cap that there are no escape hatches from.
Yeah, we can't have actually these loopholes. So we have Stan Cox, author of Any Way You Slice It. And in the next segment, we're going to be talking about rationing of healthcare. So online folks, make sure to go to www.firedupwithcj.com to get a schedule of upcoming shows. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on firedupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky. The Sky.
Welcome back. Our guest today is author Stan Cox, talking about his new book, Any Way You Slice It. I'm Cassandra from CBS Sky Radio, and we're going to go right back to CJ and Stan.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. So now we're going to be talking about healthcare and the exponential growth of healthcare. And at one point, as everything else, we're going to have a limit. In fact, we probably, one would argue, we already do have limits in healthcare. And I wanted to bring two examples that Stan brings up in his book, Any Way You Slice It. And this gives you a sense of the ethical dilemmas that we are going to have been and continue to approach as our healthcare costs escalate. So here's the question for you. You have two candidates for a life-saving treatment. One is a 20-year-old who will live for 50 years after the treatment. The second person is an 85-year-old who will live for another year after the treatment. Who would you save? So ponder that. Here's the second example that gives you a sense of the ethics involved with limiting health care. Let's say that there's a special heart pump that costs about $200,000. There's technology, it's $200,000 per heart pump. It would benefit 200,000 people and cost $40 million. And as a result of that heart pump, it would give the recipient 1 to 2 years more of life. So if we have to put limits on how much we're spending in healthcare, should we spend the $40 million and have that permissible in our healthcare costs? So those are, I don't know, to me those were incredible examples that made me really think about, wow, I understand the dilemma. It's easy to be protesting and throwing tomatoes at Obama and like, wow, you know, I don't like this, but there's some real issues. So welcome, Stan.
Yeah, you're right. And in trying to sort out how rationing works and how it should work and with various other resources, it was fairly easy to come to some conclusions. With healthcare, it's such a contentious area, and we're dealing with such deep-seated feelings that it's really hard to see what the solution could be.
Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that you brought in your first chapter or that first part of that section in your book is you said that if people were given a rational, like, here are the numbers, here's the analysis, they can easily make, like, well, of course, I would opt for the 20-year-old versus the 85-year-old. And no, I wouldn't. spend money on that heart pump. But if you have a dying person in front of you, the answers then get thrown up in the air, right? I can't remember what you called that as an effect, but that's...
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And these medical economists and philosophers talk about the so-called rule of rescue, which says that if there is some treatment or procedure that can prolong or save or prolong the life of somebody and provide an actual benefit, then there's an obligation to use it. But it doesn't specify. Yeah, and this is just something that seems to be deep in people's brains, but we aren't able to specify how big a benefit. Is it just a couple of days of life, or is it another year living in the miserable conditions? Where do you draw the line? And there are some of these economists and philosophers who say there is no line. We just have to spend whatever amount it's going to take, even with health care taking up 18% of our entire economy now and scheduled to keep rising. Do we really think, and with technology producing new treatments and procedures every year, many of them of dubious value, but they're there, and once they're in the doctor's arsenal, there's felt to be an obligation to use them. But we, at the same time, we have over-treatment being paid for out of this 18% of our GDP. We have under-treatment at the same time. As we know, people who don't have enough money or insurance, studies show consistently get much lower levels, quantity and quality of health care than people who do, and that seems fundamentally unfair.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the examples that you had in this particular chapter that I thought was illustrative of the things that you're talking about is that, was it in Cuba where, you know, their health care is actually, the actual results are pretty good, but they don't spend hardly as much money because they said, this is how much we can spend on you, we're done, right? And we're not going to give you the fancy-pantsy whatever the newest technology is. We're going to give you what we know works, and that's what all we can afford, and we're done, right? Is that in Cuba? I can't remember where that was.
Right. That's one place where they spend 4% as much as we do per capita, and a lot of that is on preventive medicine. And you know, we wouldn't – I'm not saying we should cut 96% of our – healthcare spending, but we do need to think about things reasonably. We do have methods for doing this, and that's in the case of absolute scarcity, where there isn't enough of a drug to go around, or if there's an influenza emergency and there aren't enough respirators, or in the organ transplant world, they've worked out the system for waiting lists and so forth that are quite elaborate and are very well thought out. So we know how to do these things, but what we don't know is if we have the capacity to produce these medical products. How do we decide whether they actually should be produced or not?
I thought that was a really interesting point. So maybe we should limit the amount of medical technology that's out there. You know, because part of the reason why it's so hard to keep up with it and that these costs keep on going up is because all these technologies keep on getting introduced. And by the way, they're really expensive because companies are trying to defer their R&D costs. So it's a crazy kind of cycle. And so you were talking about the, cases of like the flu virus, right? Where a couple years ago, there was only a certain number of batches. They underproduced the amount of vaccines that they got. And in previous cases, they've had limits on that. And And in that particular case, they did have some rationale, and people were okay with that, which was fascinating to me. I mean, we were on the list, and we didn't get our flu vaccination until later. But I thought, you know what, those people who are pregnant or kids who are younger, people have, you know, asthma, they should get it before me. So I think people are okay with some of it, right?
Right, and people are sensible. Where we always see what's called rationing by queuing or waiting in line is in the emergency room, and people accept the idea of triage very, very easily, that people who need care the most urgently should be seen first. And if you're there with a rash or something, you can wait until more urgent things are taken care of. One example here that they've just been talking about recently is the lack of development of new antibiotics at the same time that we have these multi-antibiotic resistant bacteria out there, but it's not very profitable for companies, and so the drug companies are making lifestyle drugs or other drugs that have to be taken every day and are expensive and have basically stopped a lot of the research on new antibiotics, which could be the most critical drugs of all here one of these days. And so you do end up with cases of rationing.
Yeah. But the one that I didn't like, there's queuing, there's providing some set of, like, criteria on who gets what first as a limited resource. And like you said, whether it's the emergency room or the flu influenza, we're able to deal with that. I think people would have problems with the technology rationing. I mean healthcare companies. but I think the one I didn't like was lottery. Where it's we can't decide what we want to do, and everyone gets so pissed off if we put criteria, we're just going to do a lottery, and whoever we draw, number 1, 5, and 10, you will get saved. The rest of you, sorry. That's the only one I didn't like.
Well, there is a certain appeal in that, and it was first used in very early antibiotic trials where they only had a very limited quantity of antibiotic available, and to do a trial, you had to have people who were treated and those that weren't, and they determined that by lottery. And there have been people who say we shouldn't play God and decide who gets treatment when there are absolute shortages like that, and a lottery is the fairest way. But then the response,
it's like God, random and unpredictable.
Right. But people respond, well, a lottery could very easily give you the result that the 85-year-old who's going to have a life extended a very short time would get the treatment and the 20-year-old would not. And that, you know, a lot of people see that as unfair. But at the same time, there are accusations of age discrimination if you do talk about rationing on the basis strictly of age, and that is usually considered out of bounds. But rationing on the basis of expected outcome is more acceptable.
All right, so folks, we have Stan Cox. We will be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com. And call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
Believe. On CBS Radio's The Sky.
Sky.
Thank you for listening to Fire It Up with CJ. Today we have author of Any Way You Slice It, Stan Cox, here with us. And you can get this podcast and any show you like, any of CJ's past shows, on newskyradio.com. And I believe you can also get it on iTunes. It takes about 24 hours. It's all free. So we're talking about, you know, saving and recycling and, you know, rationing. You can do all that for free. So if you want to listen to any of CJ's past shows, that's where you go.
You're getting fired up, huh, Cassandra?
I can tell you. I love this topic. I just circled the name of his book, and I'm taking this with me because I'm going to get this book because I believe in it.
Yeah, and I think folks should get the book. It's great. It's a great book. And, you know, I was saying during the break, what I appreciate most about this book, Stan, is that you're not guilting or shaming me about, you know, changing my ways. It's more like, here are the facts. Do what you want with them. But this is the reality that we're going to face. I greatly appreciate that.
Guilt works in some areas of life, but not on this issue.
Yeah. So I have a question. When you were writing this book, I mean, what's your net analysis? What do you feel hopeful about after doing all, it's very well researched, after doing all this research and thinking and writing, what do you feel hopeful about and what do you feel like somewhat hopeless about?
Well, looking back through the 20th century and then also looking around the world today at how people have reorganized their societies and communities and economies when faced with scarcity, that gives me hope because we generally seem to decide in those situations to pull together. People tend to prefer a system in which everybody's playing by the same rules and has the same limits, no matter who they are. They tend to prefer that to a kind of a war of all against all, and we seem to be able to accomplish it. The problem that we're can't become convinced that we're up against the wall now and we wait until systems really start to break down, it's going to be much harder to come up with these fair systems of sharing under those conditions. We're not very well programmed for a preemptive restraint, and I'm hoping that we can do that collectively. A lot of individuals do, but it needs to be.
So what I'm hearing you say is that there's what makes you feel really hopeful is that when faced with scarcity, it seems like if given enough forewarning and planning, that we can actually do a pretty good job and distribute things fairly. The problem comes in when we can't do a preemptive restraint, and then what happens?
Right. And we do, disasters are a good example. They're generally in the wake of a disaster. There's a tremendous amount of cooperation and even not just heroism, but there is a lot of pulling together and mutual aid. But can we do that if it's not in the wake of a tragic disaster?
Right.
If we can do it when that tragic disaster is up the road ahead before it happens.
Right. So exactly. So like, let's put something in place now before we have to kind of like, it's a Mad Max world and people are taking guns and shooting people for water. Whatever it may be. All right, talk about shooting people. When we had talked earlier about the book, you said you wrote a book called Losing Our Cool, which you said you got death threats because the idea of loosening our attachment to air conditioning was just so threatening to folks. So I can only imagine what the reaction is to this current book. I mean, how are people reacting to you? Have you gotten triple the amount of death threats? I mean, what's happening right now for you?
Well, I had joked that writing about air conditioning annoyed a lot of people, but I didn't think it annoyed enough people. So far, I've been kind of surprised at the lack of really hostile pushback that I got when talking about air conditioning. I don't know if it's that people realize that something needs to be done or if they think, well, this what I'm talking about is such a remote possibility. They're not too worried about it. And it could be that a lot of that hostility happened during summer heat waves, and there's no climatic event that gets people worked up about rationing.
Right, right. Or maybe they're really hot. They were sitting in their car. They lost their air conditioning in their car. They're thinking about your book. Then they started writing you notes threatening your life about them.
Well, I have had really green-type people pretty upset saying, look, don't use that word. We need to get people more interested in these issues, and if you use that word, you're going to drive them away. And as I said at the beginning, that word is going to be used, and so we should probably try to demystify it and talk about it in a practical way.
Exactly.
And not let it just be some vague threat that's lying out there in the future.
So when a powder blue Prius comes gunning towards you, it's one of these folks.
Yeah, that's who I've
got
to look out for.
Prius. I can say that because I do drive a powder blue Prius.
Oh.
All right, so Stan, this is a fantastic book. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you. It really does take a lot of courage. I can see why you were nominated last year and probably this year by the Atlantic Magazine as being a brave thinker, someone who's risked his reputation, fortunes, and lives in pursuit of a big idea. Because this is a big idea. It's a huge idea. And I think a really important one that we need to discuss. So for writing this book, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, CJ, for the opportunity to talk with you.
And what's your website if people want to learn more about this book? Can you tell us quickly your website?
Sliceit.org.
Sliceit.org. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, so make sure to go to the Stan's website, too. Next week, we're going to talk to John Grimm, a senior lecturer and research scholar at Yale University, on world religions and ecology, and what does the role religions have in teaching ethics about killing plants, trees, etc. We'll have a great weekend, folks.